Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
All right, friends, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work. This is a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's hosted by me, Kyle, and my longtime friend, Robbie. Robbie, to start off the episode today, breaking news. Here we go, breaking news. Wow, what an intro. We heard you guys. We heard our faithful listeners. Monday episodes were just not cutting it for us. So Friends from Work are here to announce that going forward, unless things change again, going forward, our Friends from Work episodes, the ones you love, the ones you've grown to adore, your best friends at Friends from Work are putting out episodes now on Thursdays.
Wow. That's huge, Kyle.
Wow.
I didn't know that, honestly.
We're back. Here's the thing. We can't promise they'll be out Thursday at 12:01 a.m., okay, midnight, but we can promise that we will get you our episodes from now on Thursdays at some point. We're thinking Thursday afternoons, which allows us some time to actually do the work, but this way we can be more current in our discussion with the current projects with you guys. So I think this is kind of a dream come true for me to go back to Thursdays. It'll be a little more work, a little more effort from your boys, but we can't wait for it.
I'm very excited. I love being able to be a part of these conversations with folks. So I think having these episodes come out whenever everything's super fresh just helps facilitate that, which is the whole point of this thing.
We also are here to announce our two winners of our Panda Express $20 gift card giveaway. Yeah, here we go. Here we go. Without further ado, just kind of cranking through this. So number one is Spencer Ford at Spencer A. Ford.
Wow.
Let's go.
Spencer.
Enjoy your $20 gift card, Spencer.
Seriously. Congrats.
Number two, Tony Dillard at Tony Dillard 314. So Spencer and Tony, let's go.
Yes.
Enjoy you some more Panda Express. I am going to be DMing you a $20 gift card. So enjoy.
Congrats.
That. Oprah over here. So not only the announcement of the Panda Express gift card, but also the announcement of our episodes moving to Thursdays. But guys, all I can say right now is that is just the tip of the freaking iceberg for what's about to happen for this fall. Really excited about launching some new stuff. There's going to be some changes, and I think they're all going to be good, and we can't wait for that.
I also want to note that the end of this episode will feature an interview with Andy Park, who is the director of visual development at Marvel Studios, which, if that sounds like a cool job, it is.
It is.
So if you see that name and you don't recognize it and you think, I'm just going to listen to the What If episode and then not check out the interview, you would be doing yourself a huge disservice, because more than anyone else we've ever gotten to speak with on this show, Andy has his hands all over the MCU. He's basically worked on every MCU project since the first Thor. It's a wild, very fun conversation. So definitely stick around for that.
No doubt. Robbie's spitting the truth over there. So part of the whole thing is that, you know, again, we put out an episode on Monday, and then what happens? The new Hawkeye trailer comes out Monday night. It's getting ridiculous at this point, which is part of the reason why we want to go back to Thursdays. Can't wait to do that. And I'm just going to add that this episode, I think, is going to be lengthy because we have a lot of incredible content. So we will dive into the Hawkeye trailer more in depth in the future. But I did want to quick say, My first reaction was that it looked kind of fun. It was a different vibe than I was expecting. And it has that Christmas feel, which is interesting. They're obviously using Christmas music in the trailer. But then, Robbie, I thought of you because I've only ever read two comic stories in my entire life. Two. And yet, watching this trailer made me think so much about that Matt Fraction Hawkeye thing that I read. There was so much from that comic here. And now for the first time ever, I know what it feels like to be you.
Oh, wow. True. See, I love that for you. I mean, if you have been holding out on reading that run and you're going to be watching this show, now is definitely the time. It is such an easy comic to read. It's a great kind of gateway if you're looking for something that's not quite as continuity heavy. And it's so funny and it's so fun. And I love how much, if you've read that whole series, the stuff we're getting, like the tracksuit guys, Lucky the pizza dog, like we get all of this stuff that's pulled straight from that comic. And it's also been adapted elsewhere. Like it's in the Marvel's Avengers game. I think it's shown up in other adaptations, but I love that. And there are some kind of holiday scenes from that comic. But I love that combined with a full-on kind of holiday movie, like a, you know, sort of classic I'll Be Home for Christmas sort of a thing. So I'm with you. The vibe is awesome so far. The chemistry seems to be good between Renner and Haley Steinfeld. My biggest question mark is, where is Laura Barton?
That's what I asked on social media as well. Like, please don't have them be divorced, please.
That's gonna be a bummer for me if they do.
Right, because I don't want that broken up. We fought so hard for it to get back together. A couple of our listeners pointed out that he does say on the phone, like, no, I'll be home, or it's okay, babe. Like, so maybe he's talking to his wife and he's just not at his house. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, if that's the case, like maybe she's gone somewhere and he has the kids or something. I'm all for, like we've said, you know, these characters going through changes, but it would be such a bummer for his character to be so driven by getting back to his family in Endgame. And then for the next time we see him, for that family to be broken up.
It would be like on the level of Jim and Pam, their relationship starting to fall apart in season 9. Like, what? We went through so much with them. Please no.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm excited to see it. We'll talk more in depth about it. I can't wait. We're going to get so much more into that, obviously, as we go along here. So, but as always, if you can, guys, take a quick second to subscribe to this podcast on Apple, on Spotify, on Google Play, on Stitcher, on Amazon, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks for making us a part of your day. But don't forget to subscribe, like, follow, whatever it's called on each format. If you can rate and review it, we would love that as well. And don't forget, follow us on social media at the FFW Podcast and check out our website, which we are constantly updating, theffwpodcast.com. I want to give a special shout out to Trinity, Selena, and Anna for donating to the podcast. Let's go.
Woo!
Wow. So girl power. Thanks, there, guys. Rob. Trinity, wow. Selena, and Anna donating to our podcast. Thank you so much. And you can donate to our podcast on the website, theffwpodcast.com. It helps us so much as we continue to evolve this thing. So thank you for doing that. And don't forget, it also helps us if you buy some merchandise. We may be looking into launching some more merchandise pretty soon. Just stay tuned for that. But right now you can get a dope shirt that's comfortable. It's soft. I have less than 100 left. I want to ship it to you directly from me to you. It says Friends From Work on it. And you can find all of that at theffwpodcast.com. Robbie, that's about all of my intro housekeeping that had to happen. And so should we just get right into What If?
Let's do it. All right, Kyle. This week's episode is entitled What If Killmonger Rescued Tony Stark. It is directed, as always, by Brian Andrews. It's written by Matthew Chauncey. Here we have a number of MCU cast members returning. First and foremost, Michael B. Jordan coming back as Eric Killmonger Stevens, aka Nitajaka. And we also have Angela Bassett as Ramonda, Andy Serkis as Ulysses Klaue, Don Cheadle as James Rhodey Rhodes. And stepping in for their MCU cast member counterparts, we have Kif Vandenhoevel as Obadiah Stane. We have Beth Hoyt as Pepper Potts, and we have Ozioma Akaga as Shuri. And that is the list of creators bringing this latest very fun episode of What If to us. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Last week, we started our episode by taking a look at where is What If at the midpoint in the season. Today, I kind of want to start by spending a little bit of time on the music front, just because we have not done that with What If really as intensely as we used to do, like definitely not with Loki and some of the other shows. But I thought the music here was really, really fun. If you go back and listen to our episode, which by the way, go catch up on all of our episodes. If you're just finding this podcast, catch up on at least these What If episodes, or all our episodes. That'd be great too. But you might have multiple times. Of work to do. Yeah. It would take you a little bit. But a couple episodes ago, when I got a chance to chat with Laura Cartman, she mentioned that sometimes the process is her writing an original song from scratch. Sometimes it's literally taking the stems and playing the song back from a different composer for those themes. But she also mentioned sometimes it's cases like this, where she got stems from Ludwig, from Black Panther, and she took those beats that she got and she put her own music over top of those. And I thought it worked so well.
Yeah.
So for those out there who don't know what stems are, stems is just when someone goes through and like sends you just the drums from the song, or just the horns, or just the strings, just the percussion, etc. And so you can have it broken down. So Laura was able to take the beat from like Killmonger's theme. She was able to take that beat and keep it going throughout the episode, sometimes putting the Killmonger theme on top of it, but sometimes even putting the Avengers theme on top of it. Like when they're doing the flash of what would have happened to Tony, and you see that scene of the Avengers circling up, it's the Avengers theme, but with that beat still going. And I just thought that was really creative and really fun. The music overall hasn't been unbelievably standout, but I did think this episode was particularly fun, so I kind of wanted to start there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think so far, this episode and the Doctor Strange episode are the ones where the music has really stood out to me. This, it's very different in what she was doing in each of those. I think what I loved so much about Doctor Strange is how she really came up with her own pretty original composition that was haunting and really fitting for that story. But here, you know, we've talked about how great that Killmonger theme is that Ludwig came up with. And I loved the way she played with that. And like you said, was able to put her own flair on that track, but then also mix it with so many other things to really reflect this movie, which was a mix of a lot of MCU films. So I thought that the score was absolutely excellent here.
My only other big picture thing to talk about before let's just dive in was, for me personally, it was a little bit of a letdown missing so many of the actors that I know. If last week we praised them for getting almost everybody in the Zombies episode, and that was so fun, then I think it's fair for me to point out that I did feel the absence of RDJ, Jeff Bridges, Gwyneth Paltrow, Letitia Wright, amongst a few others, I think. I think the people that filled in for them did a good job for the most part, but it's still kind of hard to see so many of those key MCU scenes done from a different person.
Right. No, I agree. I struggle with this some. I think in some ways I had put my expectations kind of low for Tony Stark here. And I should say, I didn't mention this going through the credits here because he's already appeared in the show. But in place of RDJ here, we have Mick Wingert. And I think maybe my expectations were sort of low because of just how essential RDJ is to that character. Like, I felt like there are other characters that you can do an impersonation of and it be all right. Not ideal, but, you know, like I think Josh Keaton's Chris Evans was really great, and I thought that he nailed what he needed to in the Steve Rogers character, even though it maybe wasn't exactly what Chris Evans sounds like.
We also praised the guy who did Spider-Man. Thought that was pretty good for Tom Holland.
Hudson Thames. Yeah. I want to say I was so worried because RDJ brings so much natural charisma to that maybe by lowering my expectations, it helped me to be pleasantly surprised. Because I thought he did a great job. I saw a couple of people sort of push back, but I thought by and large, he did a really good job of capturing kind of that early Tony energy. It's just, you know, obviously there's no replacing RDJ, but I think given that, he did about as well as I could have expected. What did you think?
I thought he did pretty well. Yes, because I'm such an RDJ fan and an Iron Man fan. That one was a little bit weird for me just because, yeah, I don't think you're ever going to replicate that specific performance, and that's okay. I thought he did a good job. The one that really kind of bothered me was Gwyneth Paltrow not being there. I didn't feel like Pepper had at all the same kind of chemistry that you get from the Iron Man movies. But it's okay. It's not a deal breaker. I still enjoyed this episode a ton. I just thought it was interesting that we were missing so many people there.
No, for sure. I wonder about this sometimes. Like, I've had people ask me, I guess we talked about this whenever we were talking about Dave Bautista not coming back for episode 2. Have people ask me, isn't it kind of a bummer that Chris Evans and RDJ couldn't be bothered to come back for this? And I know we touched on this a bit then, but I still kind of feel like part of the reason I'm okay with it is...
I totally get it, by the way. I totally get it for this.
Yeah. But, I think I'm almost... You know, it's kind of what we talked about when we talked about, the wrapping up of things that Endgame was, where, yeah, like, I know it wouldn't be undoing that, but in a way, you know, we've had such this great send-off to those versions of those characters that even though now we get more stories with them, kind of, and What If, I think I am more willing to overlook the change in the voice performance there because I respect that RDJ and Chris Evans are like, no, I'm not going to just kind of dabble in this universe here and there forever. I'm like, this was my finale and I'm treating it as such.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Think about it from their perspective. They give up 11 years of their life, of their career, pouring themselves into this, and they both get just an unbelievable exit, send off an Endgame. And then a year later, they're called back to come voice this stuff. Because we found out this stuff was being recorded, by the way, like in 2019 or 20.
Right.
So, you know, that just, I feel like that would be kind of like a, hey, guys, I just said goodbye. Like I had an emotional send off, you know, I don't know that I need to show back up. So I totally don't blame them at all. Let me talk about some of the stuff I freaking loved. Yeah. I thought it was so cool that this was one of the first episodes, and fact check me on that, where you got to see a quick little clip of what did happen with Tony Stark. And so, like, they actually did give us a rerun of the Avengers scene of the Iron Man snapping at the end of Endgame. But this idea that if Tony Stark didn't have that happen, he probably would never have become the hero that we know. And we obviously know how integral Tony Stark was to the MCU. So, for some reason, that premise really grabbed me. I think it's because I'm so obsessed with Iron Man 1. I'm obsessed with Tony Stark. I'm obsessed with Iron Man as a character. And I'm obsessed with Robert Downey Jr. So I love this idea of if his Humvee had been attacked, but he got saved, would that have been enough to turn him around? And I think it's fairly believable to think that he would have actually gone harder core with weapons.
Right.
Without Yinsen, without all that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I will say, to fact check you, I think they've given us a bit of that. Like, I think in the episode 3, since it was the What If the Avengers were never formed kind of a thing, I think they showed them becoming Earth's Mightiest Heroes there.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah, I think there was sort of that with Doctor Strange, but that was a little bit different because I think, you know, since the episode was supposed to kind of take place after the first film anyway... but this was definitely the fullest version and, and I'm with you. I've actually been wanting to do a, you know me, I'm always trying to find more ways to rewatch things. I've been wanting to do an Iron Man specific rewatch, and I've never done that. But I know some folks have put that together as sort of its own story. You know, Iron Man and Iron Man 2 and the Avengers, Iron Man 3, Spider-Man Homecoming, all of that, so on to Endgame. And I think in some ways that would be a pretty coherent way to view the MCU, because you see in this episode how much of it is framed around Tony Stark and how much, I mean, you think about how much the Avengers movie is primarily from the perspective of Tony Stark, if it's from the perspective of any one of the main Avengers. And so you see how just this moment here at the beginning of Iron Man totally changes the course of everything and totally changes, like, because what we've talked about over and over again about how Tony has to learn, not just in this first movie, but through the entire course of the Infinity Saga, how to put everything, literally everything else and everyone else before himself, whenever up until then he's done the total opposite. And so in some ways I thought this was another great case of this What If series adding more weight to the main MCU timeline, because we just see now how significant those moments and those character decisions actually wind up being.
Yeah, and it seems like this show is spending a lot of time showing us how bad things would get if right. these certain things that we have known in the MCU, like, it makes you view the MCU timeline as, wow, we got really lucky that this did work out this way.
Right.
Because it seems like, and I really appreciate the darkness of the show, you know, but this show is pretty much showing a lot of things that could have gone wrong. Our friends at Binge Mode actually posted a really funny Insta story that said, like, it was one of those memes where it says nobody, and then it's blank, and then it says, what if? We're going to show you everything that's dead and make you really sad and stuff. and it's been kind of a fun way to look at the dark side of all this stuff. But yes, right. I just love the idea of what would have happened to Tony Stark had he not become a hero. Now, my second part that I loved was the Killmonger side of this is fun too, because we got to see that Tony Stark's character would not have changed a whole lot if he was rescued earlier. But mm-hmm. I kind of like that we get to see that Killmonger's character also didn't change a whole lot in what his end goal was, even though he had a chance to by having money and wealth and fortune from Tony Stark. You know, they made it seem like it was a very inevitable part of his character, and I love that too.
No, I love that as well. And I feel like Michael B. Jordan's performance here was really, really strong.
I did, like, too. I thought I did, too.
I mean, he was the center of the episode for sure. And I think Greg on the Slack said that the whole thing would have collapsed if he hadn't kind of shown up. And he definitely did. And I think this was one of my favorites so far. Before we get into the details of it and kind of just go through the plot here, this episode really felt like a complete story to me, like a more fully fleshed out story. Not that it doesn't still end with a bit of a cliffhanger, but I know that we've talked about certain things, like even last episode feeling kind of rushed. I felt like the Peggy Carter episode was kind of rushed, parts of episode 2 and 3. I thought episode 4 did a really good job of it, and I think this episode has done an equally good job of, like, it felt like it could breathe more. It felt like there were actual kind of twists and turns in the story. I think it was a little bit longer even. Than most of the prior episodes, or at least felt a little bit longer. And so I really, like, if every episode of What If felt like this in terms of kind of the structure and the length and even, like, the editing stuff that we've kind of talked about, I think I would be a pretty happy camper.
Absolutely. One last note from me, too. It appears, and I don't want to toot my horn too early, but it appears that we were correct about the interconnectedness of this all, that there is a chance they'll come back and finish these individual stories in some way, but it's getting later and later and later, and we're not seeing a lot of development from these characters interacting with each other or The Watcher again. Like, the Watcher thing with Doctor Strange is now kind of proving to be a little bit unique. There's still mm-hmm. 3 episodes left, so you don't know. But I think a lot of people were using the shot of the Avengers circling up in the promo as an example of how these characters might still come together or still interact with each other. And now in this episode, we're seeing that it was kind of used just as a flashback of sorts. And right. So I just wonder, like I said, we might be correct. We may be running out of time for them to be interconnected. That's not bad. I'm just saying it's getting close.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting though, because there are still some promos out there. I know some folks are still adamant that we'll be getting a Guardians of the Multiverse kind of a crossover thing in the finale.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I do think there's a pretty good chance the Watcher plays some other role at some point. I think that's coming for sure.
Right. Well, let's get into the meat of this thing. I will say I missed at the very start the Back in Black sound cue, which I knew we wouldn't get because there have been a couple other moments where we normally would have and didn't.
They probably didn't want to pay $110,000 for that AC/DC placement.
Right. But it does, it would have done my heart good to get that scene in kind of full form.
Sure.
But still, how fun was it to be back in Iron Man world there?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that they're, you know, it's shot for shot. It's word for word. Like, even the bullets that come through the Humvee in the shotgun spray type pattern is like the exact same pattern.
Right.
And again, that sounds like a really nerdy detail, but I'm starting my MCU rewatch and I'm through Iron Man 2. So I just watched this not long ago. I do love the shout out and how similar it was. Even the guy gets out of the car and goes, stay in the car. It's the exact same line.
Right.
So I thought that was fun.
So talking about the first Iron Man, I think the first thing that stood out in this episode that I really enjoyed was what you already hinted at, which was Tony's character not having that big shift that he underwent in Afghanistan. Because,
like the press conference.
Yes. Yeah, I thought, I mean, so we see him drinking a lot, which is very kind of classic comic book Stark. We see him being, like, the way that he's talking to Pepper, like, just all of these little moments. It's not like he's a bad guy. Like, it's not like he's, like, Darren Cross or something.
Right.
But he is, like, way more of a jerk than we've seen Tony be, at least since, like, a third of the way through Iron Man.
Which is a really key detail. Without the growth that happens in the cave with Yinsen, does he ever really get close with Pepper? Like, do they ever really fall in love that way? Pepper probably would have needed to see his character change, you know?
Right.
Or, like you said, does he ever really decide to kick drinking, to kick alcohol? Because all of Iron Man 2 is that, but he's already had the foundation of his character changing that he's even aware that his alcoholism is a problem, right?
Right.
But without that, would he ever do that? So yeah, you're right. You see him drinking at the press conference. You see him ask for more Bloody Marys. I thought that was an intentional detail that you're right. You're seeing version of Tony that's not as kind, as loving, as forgiving, as funny, as aware. So I love that. I also thought the press conference scene in general was fantastic. The answers to the questions were very typical, like Iron Man 2, Tony Stark sarcasm, and I thought was pretty perfect. Like, don't stay anywhere without a Four Seasons. It comes off as really calloused and cold that they just lost troops and he doesn't really care.
Right.
And then I thought the way he promoted Killmonger and the way Killmonger outed Obadiah was really fun and interesting. And like, just to see Obadiah be like, oh, no more questions.
Right.
I thought it was a really good scene.
I thought so too. That's the scene that really stuck out as a great kind of combo of some Iron Man 2 energy.
Right. Directly comparing it to the first press conference in Iron Man 1, you know, just boom, boom, boom.
Where he's sitting down and the arms in a sling and he's got the cheeseburger and it's like,
right.
I think here, like that line about when they ask him, I guess, if he sustained any injuries, and he talks about
another alcohol reference.
Yeah, spilling his drink and how, like, and he says that's a war crime. And it's like, it's very, it you're right. They did. I thought they did an excellent job of nailing the kind of Jon Favreau, RDJ chemistry from that era here, which I think is pretty difficult to do.
Oh, and I love, I'm just thinking right now live about all the parallels too. We've already named like 10 of them, but I love how he was like, and that's why effective immediately going forward, like using the exact same terms to say a different thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, yeah, you're right. And then I think, so as we kind of have Killmonger enter the scene there, and grow progressively to inhabit more of this episode, because for a bit there, it feels more centered on Tony, and then it clearly shifts.
And for a bit there, I actually did think that the what if was going to be that Killmonger is good and doesn't do those things. So I kind of like that too. Because at the beginning, when you're introduced to him, I think it's somewhat believable that he's still just a military guy that's a good dude.
Right. Well, that's one of the really fun things about this whole episode is that we're getting Killmonger and later T'Challa, what, 10 years almost before the Black Panther movie would have taken place. So it's like you don't know where they are and what's going on at that moment in their timeline, because we've never really gotten much insight into that. So it helps you think, yeah, maybe this is, he's at a spot where he's not quite so jaded, he's not quite so bitter, and he would be receptive. And I thought that was really well done, because I didn't know where it was going to go. At first, I remember being like, yeah, I mean, you know, you should trust him. You should give him a break. Like, I've always kind of empathized with that character in Black Panther, you know, despite all of his like kind of homicidal tendencies. And so I think here,
that's,
you know,
your
taking
favorite
him,
part.
Right. I mean, you know, but taking him out of that context, you're like, yeah, you know, maybe he is in a spot where he needed an opportunity. Like the Watcher says, he needed a second chance. And I thought the pacing with that was really great, because you see how that could be what's happening, how he and Tony, this could be the chance for them to both grow each other for a bit there, because he's giving Tony some forced perspective and Tony's giving him the chance to kind of have a seat at the table. And you can see how that would be a good symbiosis. And then you kind of start to see things going downhill.
Right. And so then, yeah, it was fun to see Killmonger come on board. What would Killmonger be like on Tony's team? Fun to see a shout out to Tony's workspace again, which I thought looked pretty cool. Uh-huh. And then to see the dummy robot come up with the Liberator stuff. And I thought there was two other fun Easter eggs here quickly that were really cool. One, I guess I've read that Michael B. Jordan is a huge fan of anime. Uh-huh. So they kind of gave it a little shout out that it looks kind of anime, the Liberator robot. And I thought that was kind of fun. And he says, what can I say? I'm a huge fan of anime, which is kind of fun. I loved the reference to, we could make a tiny arc reactor to power it. No, that's dumb. Again, just painting a picture that like how difficult what Tony did in the cave was again. And then the third thing was, I guess at one point there was discussion of, would Tony's suits be powered by vibranium? Like, I guess originally a long time ago, and they chose not to do that. But I loved exploring that here, that Tony basically, again, assumes there's not vibranium accessible anywhere, but to see what he could do with it if he did get some, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a great, I know I saw some discussion on the Slack about that, and I believe that's been, there have been different theories about what that element was that he discovers in Iron Man 2, kind of through either novelizations or MCU comics. But
I've kind of wondered that, like, as he got to know T'Challa, like later in the MCU, would he not have asked for some vibranium to make a vibranium suit for the Thanos battle? Or does he think that the nanotech stuff is actually better with how it can regenerate and stuff like that? You know what I mean? Because we've heard that vibranium is like the most rare substance and best substance, I guess. Just an off the subject question, that's all.
No, I think that's a fair question, but I think, I don't know that Tony ever gets close enough with T'Challa for that to be an option. Because, I mean, they have those moments where they're technically on the same team in the back half of Civil War. But after that, I feel like T'Challa is kind of team Cap. So I don't know that they ever would have worked together.
It's just, again, the damage and the ramifications of civil war. You know that they never had years together. All of them, I'm saying, to do this kind of stuff. They never had time together. And then by the time they see each other again, it's not until the final fight and endgame, and they don't have time there for Tony to step aside and build a suit real quick.
I know, for sure. I mean, I think one thing I do wonder, off sort of off topic, but sort of on topic, as we're talking about what powered Tony's suits, and what if, you know, in that first episode, they obviously used the Tesseract to power the Hydra Stomper. And I do wonder if the plans for the arc reactor that Tony winds up using, and maybe even the element he winds up discovering, come from Howard's research with the Tesseract.
Oh, interesting.
You know, because he had it for decades, and I would have to think he was using that to develop some kinds of theories beyond just utilizing the thing itself, like having to try to figure out what that power type is, and maybe there was a way to sort of replicate it, at least in part. But I don't know. Could be cool.
Interesting. So then we get the Age of Ultron shout out with the ship off the coast of Africa and Claw, which we did get Andy Serkis here. So I thought that was kind of the fun cameo for the day.
Man, I love his Claw. I think...
love his Claw.
He brings a lot of life to that character.
Right, he makes him so weird, and that's what I think Andy Serkis does the best, and I love that. I want my villains like that. Like, if you're going to be a guy who deals in the black market, that's how I picture you being. That's how I stereotype you.
Right. No, I love this whole scene. Like, you know, this episode is a mashup of so many eras and locales within the MCU, some very well known, some lesser known. I mean, this scene doesn't get a ton of time in Age of Ultron. But, like, I thought it was so clever the way they worked in so much just here. Like, we got some elements of that Age of Ultron moment with Claw, but then we also now have Rhodey here.
Which, as a quick side note, I never really processed, he wouldn't have become Iron Patriot. So just kind of wild to never see him in a suit. Those suits don't exist.
And then the Black Panther moment where we just get to see T'Challa go, like, full on and just take out this entire room of people by himself.
But also, something we hadn't seen a lot of in Black Panther was Killmonger getting a chance to talk to another African-American.
Right.
Who was working for America and what he would say to Colonel Rhodes in that moment. So I thought that was kind of wild too.
Yeah, I thought I was going to say the same thing. I really enjoyed that moment. It reminded me a lot of the conversation in Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Right. My mind went there right away as well, no doubt.
I mean, and I think what's so great about it is both sides feel valid. Like, Rhodey's saying, no, I see what you see, but I feel like the only way to get the work done is by working within the system that exists.
And it's so much Isaiah Bradley versus Sam Wilson kind of in that combo.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It totally is. And then, you know, T'Challa's role within that conversation. And again, you know, this has been said, Chadwick is just killing it in these episodes. And it's crazy how much each of these appearances feel like memorials, you know? Like,
I know,
It's crazy that it's all so this was weird. Obviously written and recorded, like we talked about with AC, you know, long before what happened, sadly, with Chadwick. But
two things for me. They never chose to explore the storyline of Chadwick going dark, which is just interesting. And I'm just fascinated by how much they got of Chadwick in this record. Like, okay, I thought one episode, okay, great, he did that. Two, three, we're at like episode four of him being in this, of six, which is just kind of crazy. Maybe it's three, but either way, it's felt like a lot of T'Challa time. And so with how much time they're giving him, the fact they never wanted to explore T'Challa going bad is just kind of crazy.
And the lines that he gets, you know, like we talked about the one in the zombie episode, but The stuff he talks about here, the conversation at the end of the episode on the ancestral plane.
Yeah,
because
he's even in the ancestral plane. Yes, that's so crazy. And he's the one speaking about death and revenge and judgment. It's just crazy.
Right. Yeah, and then the Watcher's words at the very end, you know, where he talks about how heroes are never fully gone because they live on with the ones that they've inspired. I mean, it's just like crazy. But I loved it. I thought that was a really cool scene. Like I said, whenever we saw him in full Black Panther form, but then it was also a pretty moving scene. Is that kind of Sonic Cannon thing? Is that supposed to be the same technology that Obadiah uses against Tony?
I was going to ask you, quiz for Robbie. See how well you know Kyle. What tiny little detail am I going to bring up next in this scene?
Is it the vein things around the ears?
Well, not specifically that. I was just going to say that he uses the Sonic Cannon. Yes, it's supposed to be the same as the thing that Obadiah uses in Iron Man 1. But then what is his one line? He goes, geez, Stark Tech R&D is pretty legit. And I thought, that's my favorite thing ever because they're giving a little bit of a shout out when I don't like that they normally belittle that tech.
Oh, yeah. Because it's like, it's technically beating Wakandan tech in that moment.
In that exact moment. I'm not saying it's better. I'm just saying contrast that to the line I've always had a problem with where the Wakanda tech is like, haha, we're so much better than Tony. And I like that they gave a little shout out, Rob, just a little one to Kyle, a little nugget, a little breadcrumb that says, hey, the R&D for Stark department is no joke either.
No, that's true. I like that. I should have caught that for you.
I know. By the way, we're also learning that when you have a super overpowered character who is indestructible, the way to beat them is to mess with their ears. Like Wanda, when she gets the siren from Rhodey in Civil War, that shuts her down, freaks her out. Here we're now seeing this is the way to do it, paralyze them via their ears. So now we know.
Wow. There you go. I thought this scene was such a great turn because up until now, you don't fully realize what Killmonger's doing and you think he might actually be on the right side, like we said. But after this, it you see how they are taking really expanding some of the parts of Killmonger that we saw in the front half of Black Panther, where he's kind of doing some like Zemo-style planning to get into Wakanda. And what he's going through. I mean, because it's sort of a complex thing of working with Claw and like the whole museum thing and all just to wind up in the throne room so he can make this challenge. And here it's an even more complex, but I think really interesting kind of multi-layered plan of how to wind up in the position he does finally watching the sunset at the very end. And becoming the Black Panther and seeing all the moving pieces in Tony's world and in Wakanda and with General Ross. I thought it made him a very compelling villain for this episode.
Was there any part of you that thought everything he had to go through? Because after this scene, he goes back to Tony, the robot ends up fighting him. He kills Tony and the robot. Then he spins it. Like it was Wakanda doing it. Mm-hmm. Is there any part of you that when the robots actually started showing up in Wakanda, did you ever think this feels a little over the top just to gain Wakanda's trust? Like in Black Panther, he gained the trust just by getting Claw, basically. Should he not have just started there? This feels like making an entire robot army seems like quite the leap just to get the Black Panther serum or whatever. Did you feel at all like, okay, that's a lot or not?
No, I did feel that, and I was wondering, like, I mean, because he does bring Claw in, like he does in Black Panther, so, yeah, you're right, he could have just stopped there.
Well, and I thought maybe there'd be a chance to, like, turn the robots back on the Americans or something, and then use them for his weaponry, or something like that, but he basically just used them as a way to defeat them all and show Wakanda, like, look, you can trust me, and I thought, well, you know, in Black Panther, he did that just with Claw. But he did have to challenge. He did have to challenge, though, too, in that movie. So I guess without a challenge, Claw would probably not be enough, maybe. That's a good thought to myself. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering why he reactivated the robots to to then go fight them. Like, he had already, there's already a moment with T'Chaka basically saying, thank you, you know, we have to go celebrate this victory you've given us. Then he hits the button and has them turn on again. And he's like, that's not quite enough. I didn't know if that was just so he can kind of earn the trust of the whole army so they see him out there fighting. I think so. Okay.
Because they were really showing T'Challa's mom, who, by the way, we've never seen fight like that. But they were focusing on her, I think, like, constantly checking him out. Like, I don't know about this guy. And I wonder if he thought that kind of fighting would be what would be the straw that broke the camel's back as far as them trusting him finally.
Yeah, that's true. Because you do see their expressions kind of change towards him.
But I'm just saying it is a lot. It's a lot to do.
Right. I do, before we close out, we kind of brushed over Tony's death, but I was so happy to see Tony. He seemed to get a little bit of the Tony we knew, you know, whenever he's catching Killmonger in the act and then has developed the robot. And it's like, I liked that for a second he had the upper hand. But I think, I mean, you knew in that scene that it was ultimately not going to go well for him.
Yeah.
But we are destined to not have any living Tony Starks in these what-if universes, right. I think.
Yeah, one of our listeners on Slack said, I think they're really trying to make it obvious that he's not coming back because he comes back and he dies in every specific instance possible. So,
right.
Like I said, they're definitely exploring the what could have gone wrong. That's what it should be called instead of what if.
Right. That's maybe that's why Doctor Strange is like, look, in every possible reality I've seen, you die some kind of early tragic death. So you might as well make it mean something.
Yeah, probably. Also, shout out to that battle and the similarities between that and the Battle of Wakanda in Infinity War. You know, just right. with the opening the shields, all right. the drones coming in, them yelling Wakanda Forever, which, by the way, Killmonger is not allowed to yell Wakanda Forever ever again, okay? First of all, that's T'Challa's word. That is not his. Secondly, it's like the most American-sounding dude yelling it. It just felt so wrong, okay?
I think I like that, though, because it feels intentional.
Oh, yeah. It's a great decision. I'm just saying...
Right.
The MCU version of me is like, no, you don't get to do that.
I think we end up leaving this world in a really interesting spot, like we were saying, because after all this, we see Killmonger taking essentially the same spot he had taken in Black Panther before T'Challa's return without right. having to... you know, be quite as violent within Wakanda or against the Wakandans, I should say. Mm-hmm. And I think in terms of what's left, you know, we've talked about each of these episodes kind of leaving us hanging a bit and leaving room for follow-ups. I would be fascinated to see someone on the Slack kind of pointed this out. And I was thinking the same thing. You know, I think Killmonger had such an effect on T'Challa that even though we lost Killmonger there, I think his vision winds up living on in a healthier way through T'Challa's decision to open up Wakanda. And I wonder if T'Challa's final words to Killmonger are going to potentially plant the seeds for a similar effect. I think that would be an interesting way forward.
Also, we have to just talk about the fact that all these episodes now are ending kind of open-ended. This one's maybe the most resolute in a while, at least.
Yeah.
But
and the most hopeful.
It feels so intentional, though, to just cut these scenes like right in the middle of a sentence almost. I don't know if that means they are going to come back to it, but I'm kind of hoping it's like Inception, where it's fun for the audience to then just keep going down that rabbit trail and say, what could have happened? Because like right away when the episode was over, I started thinking to myself like, well, how would have Pepper and Shuri like actually got revenge on Wakanda? How would they have actually convinced like T'Chaka that Killmonger is not best for the world? You know what I'm saying? Like, but I think that's the point of the show. It's like the top not falling at the end of Inception. You can come up with ideas for how it would have gone down, but it's making you think about those things. And I think that discussion in your brain is what they want more than they care about finishing this story in another episode.
I agree. And I think I think I'd be happy with, but I think I like it being left dangling so that it's not like, oh, here's the story just kind of perfectly wrapped up.
Yeah. We have to also touch briefly on some of the other Black Panther parallels. Like, I love that when he did finally take the heart-shaped herb, that his suit was still gold, like the one we get in Black Panther. I also liked that he did get to have that sunset scene, and he basically has that dialogue, but with T'Chaka, but he's just looking over the sunset. I love the parallel there. Mm-hmm. There was quite a few fun things like that.
Yeah, for sure. And I kept expecting him to stab T'Chaka or something, and I liked that that didn't happen.
Dude, totally. I thought that was going to be the last twist. I'm not kidding. I'm not being funny. Yeah. Like, is he going to kill him now? Just like the opposite of T'Challa, and then like leave him there to see the sunset and take over. But we're left thinking he is a servant of Wakanda.
Interesting. Well, and that's why I wonder if that conversation with T'Challa is already kind of impacting him.
It totally could be. Yeah.
I, for the record, I think working through this series so far, and this could change, I think this might be my second favorite episode so far. Like I said, so much of it's so well done, and also I really love the way it weaves in so many moments from the MCU without it feeling forced. So I think for me, just for anyone keeping score, episode 4 is still my favorite. I think it's going to be hard to top the Doctor Strange episode. This, I think, is my second. I think my third is probably the zombies episode. Fourth is the what if the Avengers never assembled episode, then the Guardians T'Challa, and then Captain Carter.
Okay. I'd have to think about my rankings a little bit more, but that's actually a perfect transition, because another kind of announcement is that we are flirting with these ideas for rankings. I'm thinking what we're going to end up doing when this is over is having one mega list, or maybe we include everything, and just ever so often I'll tell you kind of like where I think it's sitting. But I do think we're going to start separating the shows from our movies with rankings. And we are flirting with the idea of just putting the original Infinity Saga under lock and key and say, these are our rankings for that. And now going forward, do we start over with a lower number? I don't know. We're flirting with all of that. So when we get there, there's going to be some tweaks to our rankings. And I'm actually really excited about that. But something I'm equally excited about is this conversation we had with Andy Park. Now, totally shifting gears here. So put your what if mind away. But you're not going to want to tune out on this, because we get into some really fun stuff. For me specifically, we get into some WandaVision stuff. We get into his development of the suits on Black Widow and a lot of other films. Like Robbie said, he's basically had his hands on all of the MCU. And you can just tell he is so passionate about what he does. So I think you're going to enjoy this conversation with Andy Park.
All right, today we have a very special guest on the show. He began his career in comics, working for Image. He worked on the Tomb Raider series that was huge back in the 90s. He also did some work for Marvel, both interior and cover art, working on a variety of titles, including New X-Men, which is a favorite of mine. He's also done a ton of video game work, notably on the God of War series, which is awesome. But we are talking to our guest, Andy Park, today, primarily because he is the director of visual development at Marvel Studios.
Let's go.
Which means he has been working with Marvel since 2010, working on Captain America, the First Avenger, and Thor, and now all the way through the things that are coming out now, from Black Widow to Shang-Chi. So we are delighted to be able to speak with Andy Park, ladies and gentlemen. Andy, hey, welcome to Friends from Work.
Yes.
What's up, man? How's it going? Thanks for having
Andy,
me.
Andy, I want to start here. Just on a simple level here, tell our audience, what is it you do specifically with Marvel, and what does a day in the life of Andy Park look like?
Yes. I am part of a group of artists that is embedded within Marvel Studios. So there's a group of us that are full-time since 2010, our department is called the Visual Development Department. Our main job is to design the characters. So the heroes, the villains, if it's a real actor, then it's their costumes. If it's a CG character like Korg, we're designing that, or Thanos, that kind of thing. As well as doing keyframes, which are single illustrations throughout the production, pre-production. We're taking the script, or in conversations with the director or producers, they want to see certain moments, pivotal moments of a show or of a movie. And then we'll illustrate that up to kind of help inspire all of the other departments, as well as the director and the producers. So that is, in a nutshell, our department. And it was first formed in 2010 by Ryan Meinerding and Charlie Nguyen, back during working on the first Captain America. And knowing that the Avengers is coming up, Kevin Feige told them to form a team of in-house artists. Because normally in the film industry, there's no full-time artists. It's usually just freelancers bouncing around movie projects. But Kevin Feige, he had vision, right? This is the mastermind of the MCU. And he thought like it would be a good idea to have a group of artists that can like work on all the films moving forward, because it's a cinematic universe. So smart guy.
Yeah. So and I'm thankful. Even on the artist level, they can help carry those characters through for a decade, basically. Then that's cool.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's unprecedented in the film industry, but it's, you know, I think a lot of things that the MCU have been doing because of Kevin has been unprecedented, right? And then for the past 6 years, so I started off as a senior concept artist, you know, so designing characters, Ant-Man, you know, Black Widow, Hawkeye, that kind of thing through the years. And then about 6 years ago, I got promoted to start leading the films. So at that point, like Ryan Meinerding, who is the head of visual development, he would lead his films, and then I would lead the other films. So the first film I led was Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And then, you know, from there, you know, Thor Ragnarok, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Captain Marvel, Black Widow, Shang-Chi, and so forth. And a lot of stuff I'm working on now. So the day in, day out, second part of your question is... It used to be just drawing and painting all day long, but ever since I became the director of visual development, a lot of my time is spent art directing. So I have a group of artists that I'll bring on for whatever project I'm leading, and then I will art direct. So I will assign out characters, keyframe moments, design work that they want us to do. I'll go to meetings with the director, have conversations with the producer and the director. And then, you know, every week there are meetings. So I'll gather up all the artwork, show it to them. They give us their notes, go back and forth. I talk to my artists, a lot of meetings, and I'm still painting. I'm still designing on a daily basis. I'm still trying to paint and design at the same time. So it's a lot of stuff, but it's definitely, fun.
Man. Well, to kind of walk through different stages of your career here, I know you talked about doing these keyframes, maybe more so back when you were coming on as a lead concept artist. And I saw on your site, and we'll share the link with folks, you have a lot of examples of some concept artwork that you've done for Marvel Studios. And one of the ones that caught my eye was a keyframe from The Avengers. And it's the scene when Iron Man is, you know, pointing all of his weapons at Loki there in the beginning in Germany. It's an incredible image. And two, I was going to see, what does it look like, you know, when you come up with that, or are you working straight from a script? Is that based on a conversation you've had with the writers and, or I guess in that case with Joss Whedon? How does it go from that to your image to what we saw on screen?
Yeah, great question. That was one of the early keyframes that I did. And it was so much fun because Joss Whedon, it was a direct conversation, right? Where he said, I remember he was telling me the moment was right after, you know, Loki's in, I forgot where that was, but I think it was in Germany. And then in that crowd, Captain America comes in. And then, of course, Iron Man comes in, that iconic moment, that music, and then he blasts him. So Loki's on the ground, he lands, and then all of his weapons open up. The way he described it was, it's the Dilophosaurus moment in Jurassic Park. So if you remember the Dilophosaurus where the ears go, you know, and then he spits at. So that's how he described it. So from there, you know, I just started painting it up, right? Seeing the previous Iron Man, seeing what parts open up. I think I might have even opened up more places than, you know, even previously. Because, you know, the Iron Man armor is always like evolving. And then, of course, painting Loki and then the Black Widows in the Quinjet behind. And then you have like the crowd. So I'm trying to encapsulate just one moment. Like usually these keyframes are not necessarily, this is the exact shot in the movie. It's more about encapsulating one moment, like a whole scene in one image. So that's why I have to kind of fit all that in. And then basically if it's a successful keyframe, they see that, they get inspired and they're like, this is great. This is, it might not be 100% exactly the shot, but it inspires, you know, all of the production from VFX to the production designer, to the writers, to the producers, and of course, Joss Whedon, and they can all be on the same page. And they, what they do is they put these like keyframes and our character designs that we do on the, in their war room, you know, as they're writing, continually writing and having meetings. So it the purpose of it is to inspire the other departments and just the whole production. So yeah, so that one was definitely an iconic and fun one to do.
Man,
I want to ask you about another specific one, because we on this podcast are massive WandaVision fans, and I saw you were heavily involved in that. And we specifically on our podcast covering that talked about how dope her suit is when she finally comes out with the full crown, the suit she's wearing. So just take me through the specifics of that one, just because I'm such a big fan of that.
Yeah, that one was years in the making, because I designed Wanda Maximoff throughout the years, like starting with the Avengers, Avengers 2, right, with Joss again. And I remember the very first design I did of her was because, you know, I grew up in the 80s and the early 90s reading Marvel comics. So I'm coming from a fan's perspective. So I had to do a quick painting of her in her kind of classic look, you know, with the crown and everything. But I did it knowing full well that Joss and the producers are never going to approve this, because I knew that, you know, I've quickly found out the story, like that she's going to be more like a vagabond kind of like, you know, just a more real world, right? So there's no reason that she'd be wearing some kind of heightened super suit, but I had to do it. I still had to do it. And they, you know, I showed it and then they giggled and they're like, okay, now do the real world stuff. Give her a give her a jacket, you know, don't do any superhero-y kind of stuff. And then, you know, I got to redesign her for Civil War. And then eventually when they gave me the assignment to lead the WandaVision project, and then they told me the story and I was like, oh my gosh, finally, here we go. And then I got to design the suit. I did, whenever you design any of these characters, whatever you see on screen, there's months and months of work and sometimes hundreds of versions of that one, you know, all variations. And a lot of times it's not even just one artist working on that design. There's like, you know, many artists trying to do different versions, and then it's up to the director and the producers to decide what they like. And eventually what you saw is the design I got to do, doing different versions of the crown. I have all different versions that I did. There was questions of like, maybe it should just be an effect rather than an actual crown. No. And I'm like, no. Yes. Yeah. So that was me. And also like, maybe we should just make it small. Cause you know, sometimes a lot of times there, you know, people aren't sure if like, is this going to look goofy? But for me, I'm always just like, just, you got to go for it. Right. And luckily like Matt Shakman, the director, you know, eventually, cause they did different sizes on Elizabeth Olsen. That's the other part of my job, is like, once I get it approved, then there's a collaboration between myself and the costume designer. They're the ones who actually make it on the actor, right? And then that's when we'll do some 3D modeling of the crown and different parts, and then I'll go to the fittings. And I remember I went to the final fitting with Elizabeth Olsen. She had the crown, you know. It's just amazing, because you know, all those years working on that, you know, from a blank page, starting of course with the source material, the comics, and then seeing it in front of me with you know, and seeing usually the actors, or they're, you see a twinkle in their eye, because they're like, they see themselves in the mirror and they're like, you know, fully realized as a superhero. So it's a special experience.
Man, that's incredible. Talking about walking through each appearance of Wanda, I also understand that you've designed every Black Widow costume since the Avengers. Is that right?
Correct.
Man, so I mean, there have been so many movies and so many iterations, and it makes me wonder, what do you think about when you're changing these designs, sometimes in bigger ways, sometimes in subtler ways, kind of based on what the movie is presenting to you? Like, how does your thought process go there when you're able to shepherd this one character for so many years?
Yeah, like, I mean, for whatever character, because I got to design like Black Widow through the years, another one's like Ant-Man, right? Mm. Or Wasp, that kind of thing. But for Black Widow, I mean, for any character, it really comes down to two things, the director and the story, right? So a lot of times, every director has their own sensibility. So for Black Widow, the changes were subtle because, you know, they didn't, every single time, they didn't want like a, you know, really big change, right? They kind of liked the overall look. So they're more subtle. Like Joss Whedon's a little bit more comic book sensibilities. The Russo brothers, you know, when I redesigned her for first Winter Soldier, then Civil War, and then for Infinity War, and then for Endgame, like their sensibilities are a little bit more real world, more grounded. So a lot of like darks and like, but that's why with Joss, you know, on Avengers Age of Ultron, I did the glowy lights, you know, because he always had the idea that, you know, she's just a human. So her suit maybe inside has like energy points that allow, like when she punches something or hits something, like it would give an extra, like a sting, and, you know, just a powered up suit.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. You don't really see it, but that was kind of the idea. Hmm. And then for something like Ant-Man, the same thing, like, you know, for Ant-Man, I'm designing it it's always based off the story. Whenever we design anything, one, we look at the comic. So we want to respect the source material. The second thing is the story that we're trying to tell, because we're not telling a one-to-one story of the comic to live action, right? We have the story of Ant-Man is very unique or different than from what the comic is. So the idea of creating the suit from Hank Pym, who's older because he's created in the 60s, and then Scott Lang's going to be wearing it in present day, right? So you kind of have to design with that in mind. And then when I redesign him for the next one was Civil War, I think. Yeah, that's the next one. I did redesign him. It's modern day. So they don't give us any parameters or any even story. Like, what should this suit look like? So that's, sometimes they do, but for Ant-Man, they didn't. So for me, I have to come up with my own reasoning. So I'm like, okay, I want to make it modern, still be respectful to the look that we've established. But in my mind, the first one, Hank designed it, so it has his sensibilities. The second one, Hank is still designing it, but Scott now, since he's Ant-Man, he's over the shoulder annoying Hank and asking him, hey, can you do this? Or maybe he's doing drawovers, that kind of thing.
Right.
So it has those sensibilities of like, some of it had a little bit of like anime-ish, a little bit like the helmet and certain things. But that's just my head. Like it's not canon. Right. It's not even something I share with like anyone, but those are the things you think of. And then for the next iteration was Ant-Man and the Wasp. Hank designed that solely by himself without Scott. So that then I'm like, I try to bring in a lot more of the aesthetics of the original, but still infuse some of the modern stuff. So that's kind of the thinking that goes on.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. So like
the audience would never know, right?
But yeah. I think the attention to detail on your part is felt, even if it's on a subconscious level from the audience, because it's like what Kyle was saying. Every time we get to talk with folks that work on these movies and on these shows, we keep hearing over and over again the level of dedication coming from the top all the way down to kind of internal consistency and this kind of general coherence, where it seems like they're, because everyone's willing to dig in like you are, from the composers to the writers to the actors, like all the way up to the executives, it feels like that's what makes this universe so real to people and why it feels like an actual cinematic universe.
Hashtag everything matters.
Yeah. And
like we always say.
Yeah. Yeah. And every different department and every aspect of the movie making process, like we're all storytellers, right? So at the end of the day, even though I'm designing the character, I'm not telling the story, but I'm still telling a story through the costumes or what they're wearing or what they look like. So that's why I infuse those kind of things, whether or not the audience ever sees that or not. Another example is Wanda. Wanda, as you mentioned, her Scarlet Witch costume, like something that I and some people caught it, like right around her collar, there's this negative space right around here. Yep. It's essentially, it's a hexagon, the same shape as Vision's Mind Stone. That's, no one told me to do that and I didn't even tell them, but it's just something that I did. And then when it first came out, I saw people like, is that intentional? And you know, they're like, no, it can't be. And, but it was, you know, something that I just did. Cause if she's creating this from her, whatever, her subconscious, you're going to have things like that. And even down to like, if you see the shapes right here, it makes a subtle W, and then right below that, it's like a V. So Wanda,
man, I little thing,
and there's a lot of V's. There's a lot of V's.
It's unbelievable.
Oh, thanks, man.
I promise I won't make you go through every character, but I have to ask. We're talking about, you know, listening to the story first, and how sometimes there's subtle changes, and sometimes there aren't. You know, there are a couple of films you've worked on where the changes are really extreme, like Thor and Ragnarok or Black Widow and Infinity War. How much of that is being informed by the script or by the director, and how much of those choices came from you?
For those particular ones were, for Thor Ragnarok, it was definitely Taika Waititi. Because, you know, I mean, that whole movie is, he's like shaking things up, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, we've known Thor for whatever, five films at that point, whatever it was. He came in with the objective to, you know, really shake things up, bring a fresh new perspective to that character. So, you know, when I first came in, I had conversations with him, and I started off with his more, what do they call it? Road-worn Thor. That's kind of like how we termed it. Cause like he's been on his adventures, whatever, at that point, was it after whatever it was, his previous
looking for
that.
The Infinity Stones.
Yeah, and then he's like, it's almost like he didn't bother to ever change. So he's got the thicker beard. He's not as regal in his looks with all the discs and everything. So he just looked a lot more like almost like Viking, right? So that's kind of the direction we went, and then it went backwards to like when he cleans up, you know, when he first sees Hela, right? So and then of course, you know, when I designed his more gladiator look with the helmet, you know, playing with like a lot of Jack Kirby shapes, and then even the way the cape, like it's like only on one shoulder and it hooked onto the back on the bottom. So there's a lot of things where he just wanted to aesthetically go in a different direction than what we've known. You know, always just very proper, godly, you know, everything's manicured and perfect. What was the other one that you said?
Black Widow.
Black Widow and Infinity War.
Oh, Infinity War. Yeah, that one essentially is her same Civil War look, but she's on the run. So they just wanted some kind of like additions. So, you know, what is it that makes her look different? Because she doesn't have time to create a new suit. So that's why like I played with, you know, does she wear a jacket? Does she wear a hoodie? All this kind of stuff. And then I did one with a vest. And then, you know, they liked that idea.
And the vest comes back.
And you know, that for that one, eventually when I led the team on Black Widow, and then we were doing designs for Yelena, I had the idea of like,
oh, it's you.
What if hers? Yeah, what if it's her vest, you know?
Wow. And then
retroactively we give meaning to what, you know, the Infinity War vest look. So yeah, things like that happen. So it's pretty darn
That's
cool.
That's crazy. I was just watching.
It's working.
I mean, I was just watching Black Widow yesterday with my wife, and we were just at the vest. That whole vest scene is one of our favorite moments
in the movie. So many pockets. Yeah.
So, I love it.
So it's funny, so cool. But then still has so much meaning now because of Andy. Are you kidding me? Right. I love that.
Yeah,
man.
I know. That's why I tell people like now you have to watch Infinity War, and it has deeper meaning, right? When you watch it.
Oh yeah. As you're talking about this group of folks that have kind of shepherded the visual development at Marvel Studios since 2010, and it sounds like there are maybe even subdivisions within those teams that work or specialize on certain movies. I'm curious what it looked like when the Sony partnership came about and you have a Sony film like Spider-Man Homecoming that prominently features Iron Man, is there any kind of collaboration between y'all and concept artists over at Sony, or is that totally done on one side or the other?
So that was a special arrangement that, you know, we never thought would happen, right? We're like, we're never gonna, we don't get the big characters. Yeah. Like, I mean, by this point, the big characters are the MCU characters, but you know, you're still traditionally, you're like Spider-Man, X-Men, all that stuff.
Right.
Like
right.
you want, as a fan, you want them to all kind of be in the same world. That's the project that Ryan Meinerding led. So that's the first one that I didn't get to work on in the past like 11 years. But the way it was treated was that our Marvel Studios creatively does that movie. So it was done the exact same way. So all the design work and everything was done by our department. And then Sony's the one that puts it out, distributes it or whatever. I don't know the exact, but creatively, Kevin Feige is in charge of like creating this movie.
Okay.
I was browsing your Instagram and I noticed you got to go to the premiere of Shang-Chi, and that looked really fun. Take us through that experience for you, getting to see a movie that you worked on live there for the first time after working on it so long.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of being full-time and working here through the years, because I've got to go to the premiere for every single one of our films. And it's crazy because, you know, we work on it. Because we're embedded at Marvel Studios, we work on these films even a lot of times before there's a script, majority of times even before there's a director, before there's casting. So we did that on Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, Kevin Feige just came to us and said, start working on this, you know, 2 weeks, come up with whatever designs you want, you know, just look at the comic and then you can just kind of run with it. And then, you know, working with the director, seeing the casting, you know, going to the fittings. I've got to go on set, you know, to watch them film several times. You know, I remember flying to Atlanta, going to watch, they were doing Endgame set. And then of course the culmination, watching it at the premiere, right? Mm-hmm. So I've done that with Endgame and all that stuff. And then the most recent one, cause we haven't had one for a while because of COVID and everything, but going to the Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings premiere, so special, you know, because it's like you're there, the actors are there, people are excited, the cast and crew are there, and it's the best crowd you can go with, because like everyone's, you know, when every scene, you know, an actor comes out or a certain moment, like everyone's clapping and they're laughing, and it's just, and then afterwards, you know, you get to say hi to like Destin Daniel Cretton, and I got to say hi to Simu Liu and congratulate them. So it's just, you know, it's a time of celebration. So it's such a special, memorable time every single time we go to a premiere.
We both loved Shang-Chi. And one of the things that we talked about a lot in our review and that I've seen a lot of folks bring up is just how visually stunning and visually unique it is from really any other MCU film, while, you know, still obviously having some MCU DNA. So when you were approaching that, is there anything sort of specifically that you did differently in terms of how you were looking at the comics, how you were trying to blend that with the MCU as it existed? Like, what was your process like to bring that movie to life?
Yeah, Shang-Chi was so special. For those who are just listening, can't see me, I am Asian American. I, you know, my parents immigrated from Korea in the 70s, and I was born and raised in the US in California. You know, having the first title Asian superhero character in MCU is certainly special. So working on this film, it's interesting because every time you introduce a new character, like we're being respectful to the source material. But as you probably know, like for Shang-Chi, it's you know, it's kind of riddled with problematic stuff from the past. So the origin. So this is one where more than any other film we've ever done, where we were free to just create something completely new, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, still, it's still Shang-Chi from the comic, but we didn't have to, like, you know, you're not going to have fans or, you know, that are going to be like, hey, you know, why is it so different?
Right.
It is quite different, right? So I think that gave a lot of freedom to the creators, to all of us. But then there was a lot of pressure, right? Because anytime you create a new character and we're obviously thinking about all the cultural aspects. Mm-hmm. So, you know, definitely there's a lot of challenges, right? But there was such a excitement anytime you introduce like a whole new aspect and a new corner of the MCU, just like it's similar to when we're first doing Guardians, we're like, oh, we're doing our first essential space, mm-hmm. like our version of Star mm-hmm. Wars, you know, that yeah. kind of thing. So that stuff is just so fun. So Shang-Chi was definitely creating a whole new aspect after 20 plus films. You know, there's still room to create new, mm-hmm. You know, we're always playing with genres and mm-hmm. with a new corner of the universe. So there's a lot of research, you know, into like historic Chinese culture, mm-hmm. Asian culture, and then being able to kind of play with all that kind of mythology.
Right.
But, you know, but so basically we're not beholden to any specific, like it has to be this part of, you know, historically accurate, that kind of thing, or this, you know, part of the comic you have to stick to this. So there was just a lot of room to play, right? And Destin Daniel, Daniel Cretton, Dave Callahan, you know, they both wrote amazing screenplay. And we were there, you know, just really coming up with the ideas. What do the rings do? The powers, you know, what are they wearing? So we're all part of that process. So like that, like for the rings, like, you know, Destin had the idea, like, you know, not to do it on the fingers. Yeah. And what if it's more like those martial arts training rings,
yeah,
and that you also see in Kung Fu Hustle. So I was like, mm-hmm. that's awesome, right? And also because we just had like
the makes Infinity it a little bit Stone, different.
So it's too similar, mm-hmm. right? So and then I had the idea. I showed it visually where maybe when it activates the rings, you know, like go separate on the arm, things like that. So and then designing the Shang-Chi costume, and you know, again. Even the way I designed, like I looked at the comic, the more contemporary version where it's that jumpsuit and he has some kind of a upside down triangle mm-hmm. motif on his chest. So I kind of, you know, starting there, I played around with just different designs. How ancient should it look and how modern should it look? I was doing a lot of different versions. And then I in my research and I came with the idea to put in the infinite knot or the endless knot, which mm-hmm. is a symbol that's used by different cultures, but definitely used in the Chinese culture for hundreds of years. I mean, it has a lot of different meanings. So for protection, no beginning, no end, the whole infinity mm-hmm. thing. And it also has a significant meaning of like when it's given as a gift, then it creates a connection between the giver and the receiver. So that certainly played into the story of what that whole kind of jacket costume that he had, you know, from the movie.
Wow,
man.
Well, I want to say thanks for joining us today. It's been amazing, Andy. But also I want to say, seriously, thank you so much for your attention to detail on this stuff, because like Robbie and I think in a weird way, probably wouldn't have a podcast if the MCU wasn't this great. And it's people like you having that much care and passion for things like that we really appreciate. So it means a ton to us. And so keep doing what you're doing. We freaking love it.
Oh, I appreciate it. And we appreciate like people like you guys who are like passionate about this stuff and having the YouTube channels and the podcasts and talking about it, because, you know, just before we end, like Comic-Con, you guys probably go to Comic-Con. Oh, maybe
we,
not.
So we started the podcast in 2019.
Yeah.
So
we've
missed them, but are looking forward to the next time we can.
Yep.
It's the Mecca of nerddom, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I've been going ever since 1992.
Oh wow. Man.
I've only missed one on my honeymoon.
Fair.
But what I love about it is that everybody's there and with a passion. They're there for a reason, right? They might, not everyone necessarily loves the same thing, but they love something about pop culture or comic books or characters, and it's just a place of celebration. So, and that's exactly what you guys are doing, right? You're just here to share the joy and the passion that you guys have for this fun material. So I'm honored to to help foster that passion that people have, and because it brings people together.
Absolutely,
right? we need that in this world right now.
Absolutely. Well, as more and more stuff comes out, one, you're always welcome back on the podcast, and two, hopefully we can maybe run into a Comic-Con, and now we can come say hi. That's a goal. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I usually have a booth there, so definitely you can. Okay. See easier to
love
find.
Love that. Well, thank you so much. Seriously.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
My biggest takeaway from that conversation, and I said it to him there as I was saying goodbye, is just that I know we say this a lot, but every time we get to interview someone who is a part of the MCU, their passion and attention to detail is what comes through. Mm-hmm. And I just love this idea that we as viewers see a suit. We get to see Scarlet Witch's outfit or the crown, let's say, right? And we think, oh, that's really cool. But you just don't go down the rabbit trail of thinking that's actually like years worth of work and thought and care for one person or one team, right? Like that was their job and they're pumped about that job. So just to hear him be so excited about one tiny aspect and how much detail he gets from that and the forward thinking from Kevin on that gets me so pumped up for what they're doing at Marvel Studios.
Man, the attention to detail there is so important because it's like we've talked about like how the X-Men movies, they just don't even try to achieve any kind of consistency.
Right.
And they're just sort of like, yeah, deal with it. It's fine. We're writers who make mistakes and, you know, whatever, that's fair. But the degree to which just Andy, and then, you know, we hear similar things like when we've talked to Henry Jackman, like people that go, I think the extra mile, like I think that they could be forgiven for not going that far. And I don't know that people would ever hold that against them. Like, I don't think Kevin would be like, oh, you did a bad job because you didn't think to tie in this vest from Infinity War. But Andy thinks hard enough and cares enough about the story to know that that would be a fun and kind of meaningful tie. And I think that at every little step of the way that the things he talked about are felt by us and are talked about by us explicitly, if not just recognized implicitly.
So good. Oh, so good.
We also got to talk with Andy for a second as he was heading out.
Yes,
And it was so fun because Kyle and I were just saying that, you know, he's been on the visual development team since 2010 when it was formed, like he said, but he's been heading up that team only in recent years. There have been a couple projects that he's been the lead on, like he said, and, you know, one of our favorites aside from WandaVision is Thor Ragnarok. And so it was really fun to hear him talk a little bit more about working with Taika on that movie and how terrified he was that people were just going to hate what he was doing and what they were doing in general because of how much it could have been perceived as just like flipping the table, which I think is why so many people ended up loving it. But I thought that was really interesting to hear that from someone that was kind of working on that set.
Yeah, I'm sure the behind the scenes of that is crazy. Like, I'm sure there was so many times where while they're doing those things, they're like, guys, what if this doesn't work? Like, what if this isn't right?
Right.
And so, yeah, just the relief of that it turned out to be incredible. And in our case, is our third and fourth favorite movie in the MCU. So crazy. His work with Hela, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
So good. Unbelievable. Thank you guys so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Hopefully you enjoyed our conversation about What If. And now our episodes are on Thursdays, so we'll see you next Thursday on Friends from Work.
Live. live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd. Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90 exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.